And I mean, what we ended up realizing is that, you know, FinHub was kind of like Hotel California. Like, you can come in, but you can never leave.
Right.
Or at least you can't leave with a no action letter is what you can't leave with.
Welcome to Boston Blockchain, where we focus on the people and projects that are driving innovation in the industry. I'm Kyle Hedman of China Shop Productions, and today's guest is Megan Spillane, partner and co-chair of digital currency and blockchain at Goodwin Law. In this conversation, Megan discusses her journey from teaching to law and how that experience shaped her approach to her legal practice. She shares insights on global regulatory perspectives and the importance of supporting clients throughout their innovation journey. Check out our links in the show notes if you want to learn more. Now let's say hi to Megan.
Okay, Megan, thank you so much for coming down to chat with us today. I know it's a busy schedule. The event is jam-packed with stuff. Thank you for getting down here early morning to spend some time chatting with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm happy to be back in my hometown of Quincy, Massachusetts.
Oh, so you did grow up here.
I did, yes.
When did you leave?
I went to college in D.C., and I ended up going to New York to teach elementary school for Teacher America after that, and I've been in New York since, but always happy to come home.
So you went from an elementary school teacher to lawyer.
Indeed.
How did that happen?
Teacher America program is really structured around committing 2 years to working in an underserved community. And then the hope is that you take what you've learned there and you go into law or politics or medicine or whatever it is and kind of just take the lens through which you can look at the world from having worked in those communities and, you know, kind of all boats rise together.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the plan was always to go to law school. My father's a lawyer in Quincy. I grew up working at his law firm in the summers and stuff like that. So, but teaching was a really formative experience. And honestly, I think teaching has made me a better lawyer because you got to be able to explain things in a way that people can understand them. You have to be okay at speaking in front of people and, you know, people that don't necessarily agree with you all the time. So it's been good.
At least it's elementary school. They're a little better behaved than like maybe a high school.
You know, they push the boundaries just fine. But I think one of the things I learned in teaching, the first time that my principal ever came to observe my classroom, and I'm this, you know, bright-eyed 22-year-old who's never really been bad at anything in my life, and I was very bad at teaching.
Mm-hmm.
The principal said to me, "Megan, I'm going to give you a do-over on this observation because you're trying to be a bitch and you're not a bitch, so the kids aren't buying it. So try something else." And so I really changed my whole approach to teaching to really be my authentic self and bring my authentic self to that. And that was one of, I think, the most valuable lessons I've ever learned. Definitely one that I've taken to law. I'm not the person that pounds the table and writes the overly aggressive email. Like I lead with understanding and trying to reach mutual ground. And, you know, being forceful, but also collaborative. And that's authentic to me. And that's actually what has led to my success, I think, in law as well. So, you know, I think a good lesson that can be applied to a variety of circumstances.
I love that lesson. People have this image of like what it means to project power. And sometimes I think that gets convoluted with what actually works when you really want to try to reach people, connect with them and compromise and find common ground. Like you're not going to do that through brute force most of the time.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's like speak softly, but carry a big stick. I
yes.
don't know. But especially, you know, working in the fintech sector in crypto, you know, whether I am trying to collaborate with my clients who are technologists and like trying to speak their language or whether I am advocating on their behalf for a regulator. I mean, you don't get very far with a regulator by pounding the table and using a big voice. You know, you have to exhibit the right level of deference and decorum while also being forceful. And really, you know, a lot of times it's actually educating them about your perspective and
right.
your positions and kind of strongly encouraging them to look at situations in a different way and have less of a knee-jerk reaction. And that, you know, I think my approach to law is actually very effective in those settings.
I wish we could get you out of law and into politics.
we shall see.
That is the mentality I think I'd like to see from more of our political leaders. How did you get into crypto then? You went from teaching to law, then to doing law specifically in the crypto space.
Yeah, so I've been a litigator by training the whole time and started practicing law in 2008. So joined my firm like 2 weeks after Lehman crashed. So I've definitely seen the peaks and valleys and, you know, have learned honestly a lot about resilience and being able to pivot and try new things and not be so wedded to a particular course. But, you know, early in my career, I did a lot of commercial litigation, but also did a lot of government investigations. And what that means is responding to a subpoena, doing, you know, your own internal investigation parallel to whatever the regulator's doing, but definitely interfacing with regulators, you know, in a cooperative posture until it gets litigious. Goodwin Procter, which is my law firm, has been in crypto since like 2014.
Okay.
We had some of those early when the IRS started going after the centralized exchanges and trying to get the information about everyone's holdings so they could like tax them for their crypto earnings. We handled some of those very early cases, and I think Goodwin, writ large, saw an opportunity to really be a first actor in the space, and I believe that we were, and you know, we still have one of the preeminent practices in the country. But for me, it was probably, I think it was in 2017. Mm-hmm. I was a young partner. I, you know, was enterprising and hungry and all this, but didn't really have like a particular area of focus. And I was talking to one of my partners, Grant Fondo, who actually founded the practice at Goodwin. And I just said, I want a niche. I want a calling card. I want to be an expert on something. Like, tell me what that is, or, you know, what the need is at the firm. And at that point, the Dow investigative report had just come out. And it was just kind of that moment in crypto where we were getting like the first preliminary guidance from the SEC on like, they're going to go after this thing. And so Grant said, you want to be my East Coast kind of crypto czar. So over the course of that fall, to get good at anything in this space, you really have to like put the work in on the front end.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, listening to Gary Gensler's class at MIT, you know, to like understand the technology and reading everything I could get my hands on to really make sure I was understanding this from the ground up. So I did that. But then as you likely remember, that fall was when the SEC started sending all the subpoenas about all the ICOs. So it was a really hit the ground running moment where I was, you know, interacting with regulators, supporting clients, trying to, you know, help guide the way the Howey test would be applied to these projects. It's been basically a growth area since then for me. So the past, I guess it would be 7 or 8 years. I'm now a co-chair of the practice. I'm working with partners across the United States and honestly across the globe at this point, tax, IP, corporate securities, our OFAC specialists, like really attacking our clients' problems from all sides. And part of the thing I love about it is that because these issues are so thorny and because there's no up, down, yes, no, right, left, you know, you necessarily have to collaborate because everything is about like risk tolerance and risk mitigation and looking at all the facts and trying to build in like enough protective factors to put your client in good stead to succeed and avoid the regulatory crosshairs. But we're constantly talking with one another to tease those things out and trying to get to the right answer. And it's far from a one-size-fits-all approach. So every client's project is a little different. Their goals are different. Their clientele are different. And so all of those are kind of the inputs that help us kind of develop the framework that we think will work best for them, especially in light of, you know, what continues to be regulatory uncertainties, to say the least.
Well, speaking of that, I mean, that is what's more impressive, I think, about what you've done, because you came into like an emerging technology field. It doesn't really have a whole lot of case law to lean back and reference, right? Like, so how are you figuring out what to tell your clients and what they need to do when there's not a whole lot of precedent?
Yeah, so you know, we're relying on Orange Groves and, you know, mm-hmm. the Howey case from the 1940s. But I think in part because there hasn't been that much to go on in the past 7 years, it really, you need to be up on everything that is occurring in real time. And,
right.
and you know, to succeed in this space, you really need to have a commitment to be constantly learning and constantly mm-hmm. devoting some real time to that learning. So what is it? It's what are the enforcement actions that the SEC chooses to file? What do the courts then say on motion to dismiss or motion for summary judgment to like tease out those areas? What, you know, how is the legislature weighing in? You know, what is the status of FIT 21? And are we actually going
right.
to make it across the finish line with that at some point? You look at Gary Gensler's speeches, you look at Hester Peirce's, you know, safe harbor programs and proposals and sandboxes. And then, you know, a critical piece of it, quite honestly, is for me and for Goodwin, working with so many clients at the same time in the space, we have really, really good market intelligence about what other companies are doing, what struggles they're facing, who's getting the subpoenas. And so you take everything that you learn from working with company A, and it can inform your advice to company
B. Right, right.
And then, you know, in particular, at times that we are interacting with regulators in, you know, in an enforcement context, in a subpoena context, every conversation is an opportunity to get a little bit more learning on what's making them tick. And, you know, it shifts over time. You know, it's very clear, you know, from the cases they filed that they continue to be focused on the centralized exchanges, but they're definitely moving into DeFi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just so you just got to kind of remain nimble. And I think keep your eyes open to all the sources of information in what is still, you know, a really uncertain time. And I can't believe, you know, 7 years in, I'm still talking about regulatory uncertainty.
I know.
We're still definitely in that zone.
But you're also kind of in like a really interesting position, being at the forefront of this and all the experiences that you have dealing with these other companies and the issues that they're having. You should be probably the person that they're coming to asking for help with guidance and the regulations and helping with like some of the legislation for this.
They being the regulators?
Yeah, I would think that they'd be coming to you and like working with you on this.
You know, it's interesting. So this was many years ago, but the SEC had developed this FinHub concept, right? Where they're like, come in. And the idea was that they put together, you know, a group of people across the various offices within the SEC, and you could come and like present your client's project. I went in myself a bunch of times. I brought clients in a bunch of times. Uh-huh. We did PowerPoint presentations. And there was this real energy on the front end of that we might really be part of something good, you know,
right.
And we're going to be able to teach them what we know and answer their questions. And like all of a sudden they're going to realize that we're right, you know. and looking back, I mean, I was so naive in having those interactions. And I mean, what we ended up realizing is that, you know, FinHub was kind of like Hotel California. Like, uh-huh. You can come in, but you can never leave.
Right.
Or at least you can't leave with a no action letter is what right. You can't leave with. So, it was very disheartening. And quite honestly, when, you know, some of those no action letters came out of that process, like Turnkey Jet and Pocketful of Quarters, it was obviously very exciting to see, the SEC has actually approved or will not pursue an enforcement action against some crypto
right.
projects. This is awesome. But then you look, and I mean, nothing about those projects. And, you know, I applaud the lawyers that worked very diligently to get those projects across the line. But if you look at it, I mean, they're closed loop. Their tokens have, you know, one-to-one correspondence pegged with the dollar. I mean, there's nothing about those projects that is pushing the envelopes of decentralization,
right,
for example,
right.
or of globalization, and a lot of we can't do much with the facets of those particular no action letters to really inform our clients that are really trying
right.
to innovate. So, you know, I think those things were kind of momentary steps in the right direction, but we still, of course, have a very long way to go.
So it's more, is it more of a do it and then ask for forgiveness later kind of a environment or?
I mean, you know, like as much, you know, I'm speaking on a panel this afternoon and we'll be providing a little bit of like regulatory overview of this year. But this 2024 has actually been a very good year for crypto, right? We see the Bitcoin spot ETFs getting approved. The ETH ETFs are right behind them. It's been a bull market. We at Goodwin are working with a ton of projects that are launching tokens this year. I mean, in spite of all the uncertainty, in spite of the ire of Gary Gensler, I think I'm seeing this as a promising time for the industry. And, you know, a time that people are, I think many, many clients are choosing to ask for forgiveness mm-hmm. rather than permission, you
right,
know,
right.
and seizing this moment. And the fact is, you don't do that blindly, of course.
Right.
You
yes.
do it taking in all the inputs you can in terms of how to do it compliantly.
Yes.
And I'm using quotation yes. marks because it's, you know, it's kind of hard to understand the true scope of that. But, you know, as a lawyer, we have a responsibility to help our clients do that with in the best way that they can, and kind of bring to bear all the knowledge that we have from all the sources that I described before, to help them do that in an informed way. And of course, not do anything that is like flouting regulation,
right,
or trying
right.
to sidestep, but really engaging in good faith with what we understand to be kind of the parameters that have been set up and how to exist within them.
This reminds me of my time in the military. If you did something that you weren't supposed to do, and it's like your LPO or not a senior officer, but if it's one of the other enlisted guys, like your LPO or your chief, it's like usually like one rank above you. And if he catches you doing something stupid, usually if you just say like, oh, sorry, petty officer, it won't happen again, that's it, it's done. But you have some people who like to be like, well, F you can't tell me what to do. I used to outrank you 3 years ago, blah, 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 blah. They lose their mind. They're the ones who are going to mast and getting struck down in rank and booted out. Like, but what drives a person to do that?
Like, that's funny.
Just be polite, admit you're wrong, take your lumps and move on. Then the enforcement is usually a lot less severe.
Yes. And I mean, you know, if you're operating in good faith, trying to get it right, using the available information, I mean, I think fundamentally the regulators, the SEC and others, I mean, I think they're trying to figure out how to regulate this industry writ large. But if you break it down to like the fundamentals, I mean, they're worried about customers. They're worried about consumer protection. They're worried about terrorism. And so there are things that, you know, trying to understand the AML KYC laws and implement those where practicable,
right?
Trying to make sure that the disclosures that you're making are accurate and customers are not being misled. Like there are some basic kind of the fundamentals of just good business that still apply here. And I think the projects that are going to rise to the top of the pile and be most subject to regulatory scrutiny, in my view, are the ones that are flouting all of that.
Right.
You know,
right.
not trying to engage with any of these legitimate risks. So I think suffice it to say the projects that we work with are not those projects.
Right.
And I just want to underscore, I mean, all of the clients that I work with really want to get this right. And all of them are compliance focused, but also trying to live like in the real world of what is in the realm of the possible when you're dealing with a decentralized technology and when you're dealing with, you know, cross-border capabilities and all of this. So it's interesting. But I think that there are solutions to be had to all these problems. But to your point earlier, I think it's, you know, bringing together the lawyers, the technologists, the policymakers, and the regulators. So everyone's kind of speaking the same language. And honestly, I think we'll talk about this a little bit more on our panel this afternoon as well, but we're starting to be able to look to successes that are being had outside the United States in engaging with some of these problems.
Such as?
You know, like the MiCA regulation coming out of the EU, where they're developing frameworks for, you know, tokens to be licensed and token issuers to be licensed. One of the cool things about that is that like it's contemplated that you get properly licensed in one jurisdiction, let's say France, for example. And once you are abiding by, you know, all of the strictures and get your license, it effectively acts as a passport where your project can then successfully do business in other European nations mm-hmm. without having to do that process every single time.
Okay.
And, you know, in my view, I mean, the United States has to be a part of those conversations because we're such like the financial hub of
right.
the world and will continue to be a critical part of the ecosystem. But, you know, as Europe and as countries in Asia and as the UK develop their own frameworks, I think the U.S. necessarily is going to have to incorporate those learnings from those other places and have that be a part of what we're doing so everything continues to kind of sing together.
Is that typically how it works? Does the U.S. tend to borrow frameworks from other countries that have, like for new and emerging technology, if it's something that we don't have, will we look somewhere else to borrow it, or is the tendency to write our own and do it from scratch?
I mean, in my experience and, you know, having traveled to some other countries, Canada, the UK, Europe. I mean, ordinarily, it's the U.S. leading the charge
right.
and everyone being
That's
like,
what I thought,
what's the SEC doing or how should we be looking at these issues? So this is like an interesting time, I think, where some of these other jurisdictions are getting out ahead and actually, you know, putting plans into place
right.
that look a lot more sophisticated and more well-developed than anything going on in the United States right now. I would say if we're looking for like corollaries in the U.S. where stuff is really happening, it's really been at the state level. I mean, you think about like New York coming up with their comprehensive like BIT license. Other jurisdictions, like state regulators that are coming up with frameworks to look at crypto. So it's good that states are engaging in that way. Obviously, the challenge is that you end up with like this patchwork of regulations around, and right. It's kind of coming at you from all sides and like death by a thousand cuts trying to comply in different states, which, you know, I think underscores the need for some federal solutions as well.
100%. What about countries like China that have gone like the opposite way and have decided to try to kick all the crypto people out of their country? Any other countries kind of mimicking that sort of posture?
I mean, China is an outlier, I think, in terms of their really strict prohibitions. I mean, there are other, like Singapore, for example, is making a lot of positive progress. Korea is making a lot of positive progress among the Asian nations. Interesting thinking about China and like the idea of a national stablecoin, you know, right. and the concerns that raises in China about surveillance and like keeping track of what everyone's doing and all that, which are things that are so antithetical to like the primary tenets of right. crypto, right? But I think it creates, you know, when you look at the stablecoin bill is like among the proposed legislation that's kind of kicking around in the United States right now. And I think for those of us that are in the space for a while, I mean, the stablecoin one seems like the one that should be so obvious and should be able to get through quite easily, right? Right. Especially if you're talking about one-to-one coins that are always completely backed by the U.S. dollar. It's kind of like, yes, this is the future, and like reasonable minds should not differ that this should right. be like just another, you know, form of recognized payment. But I think that there are legitimate concerns about surveillance and about like the US dollar, the fiat currency no longer being like the primary driver of the world economy. And, you know, I think they're in, obviously crypto has unfortunately, in my view, become very politicized at this point. And I think it has to be not even a bipartisan issue, but a nonpartisan issue.
Yes.
And that, you know, using it as a political pawn in this election cycle, I think will only serve to push things back and to kind of stifle innovation rather than kind of everyone moving forward in the same direction.
I mean, you can say that about more than just crypto. Like the country could use a lot more listening and less yelling.
I don't know, that's true. But I think, you know, I think, you know, people have their battle cry about like firing Gary Gensler. And I, right. you know, I can't say that I disagree. But at the same time, like, let's all figure this out. Much like...
Do you want to start over with somebody new?
Right. So yeah, an interesting time for sure. And I'm sure that like the election's on a lot of people's minds, obviously. And
I think that was the last thing that we heard from somebody was that there's probably going to be no legislation until after the election at like the very earliest.
That's the thinking on the street as far. I mean, FIT21 making some progress in the spring and into the summer was obviously an exciting development, but I think, yeah, like anything actually getting done, I think we're probably waiting until
inauguration day.
Yeah. Or, yeah. You know, yeah. Early next year. Exactly right.
You work with a lot of companies then. Like what are some of the common things that they're coming to you for? What are some of the things that they're struggling with that you're helping them with? Or what sort of advice are you trying to give?
Yeah. So Gubin has, we call it like a life cycle practice. So that means like from your earliest like seed rounds of investment all the way through companies that are trying to go public, we're representing kind of every stage. So the clients that I work with, I work with a lot of fintechs generally, as well as blockchain companies in particular. I mean, the best time for them to come in is like when they have their idea and it's coming to fruition and they need help teasing out kind of the contours of their tokenomics or like how their right. protocol will function or who it will be available to and all that, so that we can help them craft that stuff on the front end. So it's you know,
the earlier the better.
The earlier the better. Yeah. Yeah. Rather than trying to fix something after the fact. And then, you know, as I said, I'm collaborating on a daily basis with my corporate colleagues who can, you know, do their funding rounds and set up their, you know, if they're setting up a foundation, for example, or any of the corporate docs. And then, I mean, we can lead them all the way through launching a token. We can deal with the IP that comes with, you know, who's going to hold the IP to the actual protocol, who's going to hold the IP right. to the token itself. Sometimes those are transferred from the DevCo to the foundation. We can like help with that. There's tax implications to all of that. So it really, I think in order for us to be really successful at stewarding our clients through the whole process, you're really pulling in like half a dozen subject matter experts to to weigh in on these different things.
Right, right.
And you know, that's why it takes some really time and commitment and frankly some money to do all these things correctly.
Yeah. I've got one other good question for you then. This is going to be completely off the wall, but as a lawyer, what is the best show or movie that accurately depicts your profession?
Oh my goodness. I would love to say My Cousin Vinny. I don't know.
I've heard that one actually a lot.
No, I honestly, there were components of My Cousin Vinny that were actually used by some of my professors in law school for like good courtroom advocacy.
I'm pretty sure Legal Eagle on YouTube has actually reviewed that one. And like, that was one of the ones that he was actually more surprised at how accurate it was.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then on the other end of the spectrum, you have things like Suits and those things that are online. They're just like, just wackadoo. I wish working at a big corporate law firm was that glamorous and sexy. Right. It is not. But yeah, I don't know. I tend not to watch law dramas. I use my TV to really engage in the light delights like the Bravo franchises and the Love Islands. But
nice,
you know,
nice.
you work hard all day. You need a little junk food for your brain at the end of the day sometimes.
Yeah, usually it's not what you've just spent an entire day doing you want to watch again.
Exactly right.
If you want to know the best, most accurate submarine movie, I would point to either Das Boot or Down Periscope.
Okay. A Down Periscope I've definitely seen.
Anything else you want to say before we wrap things up? If people want to learn more, where can they find you?
Yeah, I goodwinlaw.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm speaking very frequently. I would encourage everyone to look at some of the thought leadership that we put out, specifically the litigation group. We put out like a quarterly update of kind of all the happenings in enforcement and legislation that have happened over the course of the year. And I think what is unique about what we put out is we try to give you some actually like inside baseball and some scoop rather than just summarizing everything.
Yes, okay.
So it's a good one-stop shop that gives you a little bit of an insight into how we're thinking about these things.
And that's on the website, Goodwin?
At goodwinproctor.com, yeah.
Perfect. We'll make sure that that's in the episode description.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your time today. I'm looking forward to watching your presentation this afternoon. Again, I wish about half of them we're able to get people after the presentation. The other half is before. So probably have to schedule a follow-up at some point.
All right. Yeah. Happy to do it.
Well, thank you very much.
That was fun.
The cover art for this podcast was custom designed for us by the amazing people at Epic Made. Epic Made is a digital art and animation studio that actually understands the magic behind powerful creative assets for gaming, entertainment, and tech. So visit epicmade.com to get expert creative help for campaigns, commercials, socials, and more. That's epic-made.com. DSpark is the leading user research platform for Web3. Companies can easily get feedback from any type of user, helping them build better products and improve their marketing. If you're interested in giving feedback, get paid USDC to share your opinions and improve Web3. Visit DSpark.io today. That's DESPARK.io. Bola allows you to create, tokenize, and finance invoices and manage all of your on-chain accounts. With TCS Blockchain, they recently went live with their groundbreaking solution that uses blockchain to settle freight invoices 90% cheaper and faster than traditional means. Thank you for helping make this show possible, Bola. Go to bolanetwork.com and tcsblockchain.com to learn more and join the waitlist. Numbers Protocol harnesses blockchain technology to enhance authenticity and traceability of digital content globally, with operational bases in London, LA, Dubai, and Taiwan. Recognized as the best in Web3 at the 2023 SXSW Awards and supported by Google and NVIDIA, Numbers Protocol offers the Capture, an all-in-one suite for content verification, copyright protection, and monetization. This technology has proven pivotal in projects like the archival of the 2020 U.S. presidential election and supports artists and businesses in ensuring the integrity and security of digital media. Jotto is a cutting-edge platform that amplifies the customer voice by making it simple for organizations to gather feedback through video, audio, and text. Using powerful AI, Jotto analyzes this feedback in real time to deliver actionable insights that help organizations understand their audience better. Whether it's governments, businesses, or events, Jotto enables a deeper connection by ensuring every voice is heard and valued. It's an essential tool for anyone looking to turn raw feedback into strategic actions and drive meaningful engagement. So once again, thank you to our sponsors for helping make the show possible, and thank you everybody for listening. The views and opinions expressed on this program are their own and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any affiliated entities. The information shared in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial, legal, or professional advice. Always conduct your own research and consult with a qualified professional before making any decisions based on the content of this podcast. We appreciate your understanding and hope you enjoy the insights and expertise shared in today's episode.